Thank you for such an extensive... it's rather a bit like what St. Peter might reel off, you know, when I meet him briefly, I'm sure. Okay, so today I want to talk about a paper which considers a school production of R.C. Sheriff's 1928 anti-war play, Journey's End, at Stonyhurst College in 1930, under the direction of a Jesuit priest who had served as an army chaplain in the First World War. The production was presented on the occasion of Shrovetide, which, I argue, in tandem with a wider tendency towards the beginnings of the memorialisation of the war dead, effectively allowed for the production to be read in Catholic liturgical terms. Thus, the production is considered as an intervention which sought to concentrate young minds on questions related to religious worship and commitment at the point of a rapidly changing world, and in anticipation of their own coming roles in the Second World War. This is based on a publication, an article that was published in the Downside Review. And indeed, I've brought along some photocopies. It's open access, so if anybody wants a copy, they're really, really welcome. Okay, for me, this is, I guess, part of a sequence of articles looking at Jesuits and theatre. There we go. Here was the previous one on Daniel Berrigan, who wrote a play about his trial further to the burning of draft cards. Then he went on the run and was occasionally would pop up to say mass. The FBI were after him. He was on the most wanted list for a while. He died a couple of years ago after many years of activism and was a notable poet and playwright. So that was the previous one, and then this is the current one, and I'm not sure what will be the next. So Journey's End was written in 1928 by R.C. Sheriff, and it was based on his own experiences in the First World War, which included being seriously wounded in Passchendaele in 1917. The play was first performed in 1928 as a one-off at the Apollo Theatre, starring the 21-year-old Laurence Olivier, who of course would become the preeminent actor of his generation, in the lead role, under the direction of the Dudley-born James Whale. I mentioned Dudley because I'm going to come back to the Midlands in a bit. The production transferred to the Savoy Theatre with Colin Clive replacing Olivia and proved to be wildly popular during its initial two-year run. Whale would then direct the Hollywood film version that was released in 1930, with Clive retained in the lead role, where his brooding introspection and in vino veritas voicing of self-doubts made for a compelling performance. James Whale, of course, went on to make a number of the great Hollywood early horror films of the 1930s, with Colin in them as well, playing Frankenstein. "It's alive, it's alive." That was one of his lines as Frankenstein is animated. Colin had the, you know, the looks and the talent to be an absolute Clark Gable level leading man, but was keen on the bottle and was often found asleep on the set. Had to be sometimes sort of held up so they could do over the shoulder shots because he was too drunk to stand. Had a fear that his leg was going to be amputated, and then died in his late 30s, having never really got where he could well have done. These productions of Journey's End, well, I think in some respects, in education for women whose husbands had been in the First World War and had not talked about this traumatic experience, and of course letters back were censored at that point, which features in the play. And indeed, women were noted as a sizable demographic of the audience of the play. This tendency to discretion or silence on these matters was something that the Jesuit war chaplain, Father James McCann, recalls in his recollections of the Great War, and the sense that the experience was near indescribable. He writes, "Of the war itself I shall say nothing, and I shall leave the hardships and discomforts to the imagination, as I don't believe that any words can convey to anyone who was not in the war what life in the trenches was like." In Sheriff's conveyance, then, for both those who did know and those who didn't know, the veterans who knew only too well, of course, the play was clearly a reenactment, an education, but also with possible therapeutic gains as well. The play lends itself, I guess, to boys' schools productions as well. The stage design, the stage directions for the setting are quite familiar from boys' schools, except for the table. This is within the play. Except for the table, beds and seats, there is no furniture, save the bottles holding up candles and a few tattered magazine pictures pinned to the wall of girls in flimsy costumes. As well as the particulars of the play, letters to parents, talk of sporting achievements, of girlfriends, of entertainment seen on holiday, of tobacco and alcohol, complaints about the food, complaints about the serving staff as well. And Journey's End, as with the experience of being at school, consists of time-filling banter, uneasy camaraderie, black humour, between those of a privileged, i.e. officer class, away from home. Sheriff would note the lack of female roles in the play as making the play ideal for boys' schools productions, to the extent that his eventual autobiography was called No Leading Lady. The 1930 Stonyhurst production was arranged and recorded in the Stonyhurst magazine as within the tradition of Shrovetide celebration events. Let me just quickly give you a wee bit of background. Here's Stonyhurst itself. As you can see, I'm being chased off by the security when I took this picture. And here it is today. This is when I was last there a few months ago. John Henry Newman's Beretta, just around the corner from the girls' dormitory. And the main St. Peter's Church, and then the side view. This is the Academy Room, which was the theatre, which was done up in 1930. So this production of Journey's End was the first big production further to it being done up. And here, you can't see, but there's a picture of Peter Glenville, who was, as a young boy, was in Journey's End. And then as an adult, became extremely notable as a theatre and film director. He's forgotten now, but he directed everybody, Richard Burton, Liz Taylor, Alec Guinness. He worked quite extensively. I think he was Alec Guinness's sponsor in Alec's conversion. Peter O'Toole, he worked very extensively, but he died in 97. The foundation set up in his name paid for a more recent refurbishment of this theatre room, where boxing also used to occur, which takes me back to the culture of the 1920s, which is a lot less cushy than it is now. As you can see, high religious ceremony, cross-country, obviously it rains there constantly, getting very muddy. This study room, mass study, this was a notoriously ungovernable room for teachers. And this innovation of the indoor swimming pool that was called the plunge, that was still in operation when I was there in the mid-late 1980s, heated by a Sol hose pipe. It's since thankfully been demolished. There's quite a few questions about the quality of education at Stonyhurst in the 1920s, as well as it being, as Philip Caraman once observed, Spartan. Peter Hardwick, in reviewing the autobiography of the future editor of The Tablet, hones in on an interesting instance, perhaps far from isolated, of an astonishing richness and receptiveness, both in terms of people and the circulation of writing and ideas. Peter Hardwick writes, all the mud and the rugger and the cadet force and the smoking and the ferulous, i.e. the thrashing, and somewhere in the building, Tom Burns and Henry John are reading the latter's copy of James Joyce's Ulysses with Martin Darcy, who in return introduces them to the poetry of Gerald Manley Hopkins and the mystical theology of Friedrich von Hugel. Do we all understand? 1923. Ulysses had been published and banned for scarcely a year. The copy had been smuggled in from Paris. The first small edition of Hopkins's poems had not yet sold out, and von Hugel's essays and addresses had been with us only since 1921. One can feel the sense of possibilities afoot and of wonders over the horizon. Of course, you might see all this differently and say here was a brace of effete boys consorting over a dubious book with a somewhat precious priest, but nonetheless, the point remains. I think I should note as well that the situation of the school, Percy Fitzgerald, writing under the pseudonym One of the Boys, for a book that was potentially so scandalous he changed the name of the school. It was called School Days at Saxonhurst, 1867. Talks about how remote and foreboding it is. It lay in a rough, blustering country, in a rude part among fells, where there were very raw and severe winters and fine oppressive summers. From afar off, the eagle-capped towers rose out of rich wooding with good effect, and many a driver's whip was lifted up to point it out with a "that'll beat at school" in the Lancashire accent. Then they, the Baron's boys, drove away. As he looked after them down the avenue and saw them turn the corner, the new boy seemed inclined to raise a howl, feeling the sudden sense of desolation. Yes, to be precise, this is the avenue your parents would drive away from, having deposited you there. And there are the Eagle Towers. So the staging of the production of Journey's End was under the direction of a Jesuit chaplain and a veteran of the Great War, and indeed a Stonyhurst Old Boy alumni himself, Father Frederick W. Plant. And the schoolboys who would play the roles in Journey's End would have been born in the late 1910s, and so would have been too young to have fought in the First World War. Their enactment then was one of proxy. They may well have had brothers and fathers who fought, and maybe died in some respects, as I've noted. From a contemporary perspective, the production could be understood as therapeutic for them, allowing those involved to begin to address the collective trauma for families, for the social fabric of British society, and to begin to think about or consider afresh the experience of those directly involved in the war. But this therapy was also institutional. The play as a memorial to the old boys who had died, but working with feelings, imagination, and empathy via the sheriff text, rather than marble and name roll calls as per actual memorials or dedicated religious services respectively. In fact, there were quite a few memorials that were beginning to be built in the UK in the 1920s. Chapels, sporting facilities, often developed with bursaries and monies raised by schools and the alumni associations. And this was also the case at Stonyhurst in 1923, with a memorial to its alumni war casualties. The names of the fallen, drawn from campaigns stretching back to the early 1800s, were reproduced in lead, set in marble, covering most of the memorial's service. The memorial was situated just steps away from the academy room that we've just seen, in which Journey's End would be performed. And indeed, there is a picture of it somewhere here. So on the left is the memorial at the point at which it was built in 1922, and then, of course, much more populated on the right as the memorial presently. This picture on the left is from the Stonyhurst War Record, which was a book recording the dead and what had happened to them. The names of the fallen drawn from campaigns in the First World War, and Joseph Keating, reviewing the book for the month in 1927, opined, "Have all these gallant lads suffered and died for no better purpose than the mere postponing of another and worse conflict? Will the college, some generations hence, be compiling another similar record, chronicling the brief lives and the heroic deaths of children yet unborn?" Keating, of course, was quite correct. The Roll of Honour would be considerably expanded after 1945, edging into the territory of those who, in 1927, were yet unborn. Those born in the 1910s, in this production of Journey's End, and in the audience for the play, would have then become caught up in the Second World War, and may also have found themselves in the trenches, actually enacting in a theatre of war what they had once reenacted or experienced in the Stonyhurst Theatre. Let me take you back to look at a couple of photos then of the production. Here's the cast itself. And these photos, I think, were taken by Frederick Plant as well, who was a very keen photographer. So here they are at the front of the college, got up in their cadet force kit, which I guess was also their uniform for the play. The play itself created the underground dugout on the stage, complete with actual frying bacon, the smell enveloping the audience. So as you can see, there's a kind of intense microscopic focus on what's going on. It's immersive. You're very much there with them. And as tension builds, because they're waiting to go over the top, and of course, you know, death awaits them, the title of the play being Journey's End, you feel, I would guess, quite a lot of empathy. Offset by, for example, here, discussions of drying socks So it's the trivial and the operatic and the tragic all mixed up together. It was during the Savoy run of Journey's End that Colin Clive, who had been a student at Stonyhurst, as indeed the great actor Charles Lawton, seemingly suggested that Stonyhurst mount a production. And permission was sought and granted by Sheriff, who agreed to cut some of the richer language as well. I would surmise that the suggestion was made directly to Frederick Plant. And Plant would have had immediate empathy. He had been a chaplain in the Great War at the rank of captain with the Sherwood Foresters and had been posted to Flanders for active service in May 1918. In this, he would have arrived at the point of the aftermath of the brutal Battle of Ys and for the Fifth Battle of Ypres, with tens of thousands of British soldiers killed and injured across these months. Chaplains were known to place themselves on the most dangerous locations and often muck in terms of any tasks that needed doing. In all likelihood, Plant had joined the Jesuit order upon leaving Stonyhurst in around 1904, and by 1908 was studying for an arts degree via the University of London while based in the Jesuits' Manresa House, Roehampton. He was ordained on the 25th of April 1918, immediately made an army chaplain, and left for France on the 21st of May. So less than a month of being ordained, he was absolutely in the thick of it. He had been teaching at Stonyhurst prior from 1912 to 15, and then with interruption from 1922 onwards. Plant would leave the Jesuit order not long after the Journey's End production, in January 1932, at the age of 47. The reasons for this remain obscure, but here from the Jesuit archives, we have 1932, January 15th, this. Short for dismissed, which doesn't mean dismissed in terms of chucked out, but requested dismissal, and this was granted. He then became a secular priest, and I can only speculate on the reasons for this. They're not recorded. It may have been theological differences of opinion related to behavioural or disciplinary matters, or simply his choice. Perhaps the experience of the production re-traumatised him. And I think as well of the poem by Auden, September the 1st, 1939, when Auden looks back on the decade of the 1930s, uncertain and afraid, beholding our world which in stupor lies, and then talks about clever hopes expired and the low, dishonest decade. Perhaps Plant wanted to remove himself from these narratives and anticipated tragedies in the downward spiral to the next great war, which would include the boys that he had directed. And this required an exit from the Jesuits and so Stonyhurst and the company of its boys for a quieter posting. There's a record of 1937 in the tablet. He's mentioned clerical appointments as having resigned as parish priest of St. Helens and Oldcoats owing to ill health. But I have no photo and no information on when he died. And I was reluctant to push it a bit further, in fact. And maybe this photo is why I was reluctant. And this wasn't in the Downside Review article, Simon. This is so we're going to get a bit gossipy now, if that's okay. But anyone with a kind of gaydar sensibility would know most photos, sporting photos, are quite rough and ready. There's always somebody pulling a face and someone laughing. But this is beautifully arranged. This is one of Plant's photographs, slightly Uranian in these two at the bottom. There's somebody perhaps about to laugh at the bottom. Top right, rather. Mm. But nonetheless, this, I think, evidences an appreciation of the beauty of young men. And arguably, maybe that was Plant's sticking point. But it would be grossly irresponsible of me to speculate in print about that. Because, in fact, the Midlands Plant family was somebody that... I'll come back to that in a second. Anyhow, so rehearsals occurred in February and March 1930. With a performance on Quinquagesima Sunday, with very great success, and then a second performance on Shrove Tuesday, which was allotted as a holiday in the school calendar. On Shrove Tuesday, it went better. Quote, a large gathering of guests were present, and all were loud in their praise for the high standard of acting achieved. The Stonyhurst magazine notes that Sheriff was to be present, but was delayed and couldn't get there. And this is what the magazine says about the productions. What was most striking on the Tuesday night was the extraordinary stillness of the Academy Room, not merely once or twice when the action was most gripping, but over and over again. Now, this was the second time that the majority of the audience has seen the play. It was acted on the Sunday before, and it was a sure test of its merits. The magazine also compares the play to Henry V. And it, I don't know who wrote all this, by the way, the review. And it talks about Henry V as dealing more with what man is rather than what he does. And in Journey's End, we look all the time at what men are. So there's a kind of existentialism over some sort of spiritual, ontological, psychic sense of the soul or what makes us. So in this respect, it identifies the play as a kind of psychological exploration and acknowledges the worth of the engagement with contemporary material when Shrovetide plays were typically like comedies or Shakespeare. But it also, the play, the production, represents a rejoinder to the jovial criticism made by MacDonald Hastings in his book Jesuit Child that recalls this particular time, his experiences at Stonyhurst. He says that the Jesuits, quote, devoted an unconscionable amount of time getting us ready for the next world before we were even ready for this one. The play firmly roots us in this world. The text, indeed, has no intimation of religious dimension or spiritual salvation. And it even positions the ultimate sacrifice of death as lacking in dignity or much meaning. And it mounts this psychological, biological exploration of what men are. The experience of Journey's End, enhanced by the intimacy of the production design and strategy, is exactly one of navigating this world rather than the next. The extensive coverage of the play in the Stonyhurst magazine, which is what prompted this research, because it seemed quite unusual to me, as well as such an anti-war play being performed in 1930, includes notes from the top benches, which are responses from pupils that may have been gathered in English lessons after they'd seen it. One pupil says, one comment praises the way in which the play encapsulates the way in which some, facing certain death, seem to have a pre-recognition of this and act accordingly. I consider this extremely well thought out by the author, writes the anonymous student. Another reaction is quite disturbed. And the pupil suggests there should be a new final scene in which we're back in the in England, a proper ending, they call it, where two of the soldiers are still alive, and in fact one is courting the sister of the other, and they're now together and married and so on. Clearly, this would offer a glimmer of hope of life continuing and historicise and so safely quarantine the horrors seen. For this pupil, the play must have seemed entirely too bleak. I mentioned then that the play occurs under the auspices of Shrovetide, i.e. a kind of religious celebratory holiday, of which there's very little critical literature that I could find. And these recorded reactions from the pupils, as well as this absence of spiritual or religious element to the play, which may have offered a vector through which to make a kind of sense of the death, both deaths both on the stage and in their families in real life, seems to have stung. So the production can be considered in relation to evidence of a wider theological intervention. And it is this sting and consequent desire for sense-making that I turn to as my final comment in this paper. It holds out the idea of progressive theological thought arising from the event. And this is also a kind of rearguard action in terms of the role of religion during these years. The first Stonyhurst War record considers the way in which the Great War was effectively one in which religion was on its trial. And it reproduces reports from chaplains that talk about a kind of salvation. The people even dying in the mud were saying prayers. One person, Brigadier General Paul Aloysius Kenya, is identified as an old Stonyhurst boy and requests a crucifix from another soldier who comes across him. The 2 hours I spent with him, I shall always remember, that soldier says. It was grand to see the comfort and relief these simple objects of piety gave his mind. So his death in this report is lent the kind of transcendence that the play Journey's End itself seems to deny. And the particularity then of the Stonyhurst production, unlike professional West End productions, makes good on this deficit, since the production effectively existed in a liturgical space. This is what I mean by that. I'm going to use a whiteboard. So we have these corridors, and this is on the first floor, and we have the theatre, which is just here. And then we have the war memorial, which I mentioned is here with kind of candles. So right the way down this corridor, we have one chapel here, we have one chapel here, and there's another chapel there, and there's a shrine here. And to get to the theatre, you have to go by this memorial. And indeed, as you process down here, as you walk down this way, you would see maybe the candles lit, you would see the names of the old boys who had died, and then on into the theatre for this immersive experience of the play itself. So in a way, this transforms the building into a kind of church space, with the corridor as the kind of aisle and the classrooms as the pews on either side, for then a kind of meditation on what we are, the death, the meaning, trying to grapple with the trauma and the tragedy. The audience immersion into the hellish dugout then is offered a kind of mitigation in this. And it's now fitted into the central Catholic narrative of sacrifice, death, and meaning. In the most general of terms, the Church heading to Vatican II would attempt to address and fit the modern age in its purview, grappling with secular governments and the legacy of the Great War, and find renewal in this move. Vatican II, some three decades later, in Sacrosanctum Concilium, would also call for, quote, legitimate variations and adaptations of the liturgy, especially in mission lands such as, at a stretch, wind-battered Stonyhurst with its majority Protestant population in Lancashire at that point, and its raw and severe winters, as that pupil was complaining about. And these adaptations could include processions and the arts. On a comparable, then, if microcosmic and preemptive level, Plants Enveloping of Journey's End in the Shrovetide context, a production of realism, devoid of spiritual dimension, and yet a spurring on thought and memorial meditation, an attempt to make sense of the modern world for its young members, could then be read as an experiment in the spirit of liturgical renewal. Have I got time for one quick coda?
Very quick.
After I'd submitted the article, I went to a party, which sounds like I have a very glamorous life, but it wasn't. It was just it was just parents with kids the same age as mine complaining about things. And somebody was stood by a table going on about how good this beer was. And this beer is called Neck Oil. And I was vaguely aware that Rob Plant's son owned a brewery. And when I checked, indeed, it turned out that Neck Oil was Robert Plant's son's brewery's beer, which was great according to the slightly drunk person I was talking to. And indeed, it turned out from some basic genealogical research that Robert Plant was the... Frederick Plant's brother was Robert Plant's grandfather. So there's a direct connection. So I looked up online when I got home and I found an interview with the son who we see here, Logan Plant, who said the name Neck Oil comes from my dad, who said that his grandfather would get back from work in the Midlands, sit down and say, I'd like some neck oil, meaning beer. So in this amazing moment, I realised that despite talking about a production almost 100 years ago, no one alive now who would have seen it or recorded it, and all the kind of mystery surrounding the people involved in it, we were really only one conversation point away from, you know, this Plant family and their mythology and their language and where they're from. Anyhow, thank you so much.